Anno Domini 2000, or Woman's Destiny, by Sir Julius Vogel. Prologue, AD 1920. George Claude Sansius in his early youth appeared to have before him a fair, prosperous future. His father and mother were of good family, but neither of them inherited wealth. When young Sansius finished his university career, the small fortune which his father possessed was swept away by the failure of a large banking company. All that remained from the wreck was a trifling annuity payable during the lives of his father and mother, and this they did not live long enough to enjoy. They died within a year of each other, but they had been able to obtain for their son a fairly good position in a large mercantile house as a foreign correspondent. At 25, the young man married, and 3 years afterwards, he, unfortunately, met with a serious accident that made him for 2 years a helpless invalid, and at the end of the time left him with his right hand incapable of use. Meanwhile, his appointment had lapsed, his wife's small fortune had disappeared, and during several years his existence had been one of continual struggle with ever-increasing want and penury. The end was approaching. The father and mother and their one crippled son, 12 years old, dwelt in the miserable attic of a most dilapidated house in one of the poorest neighborhoods of London. The roof over their heads did not even protect them from the weather. The room was denuded of every article of furniture with the exception of 2 worthless wooden cases and a horsehair mattress on which the unhappy boy stretched his pain-wrung limbs. Early in life, this child suffered only from weakness of the spine, but his parents could afford no prolonged remedial measures. Not that they were unkind to him. On the contrary, they devoted to him every minute they could spare, and lavished on him all the attention that affection comparatively powerless from the want of means could dictate. But the food they were able to give him was scant instead of, as his condition demanded, varied and nutritious. At length, chronic disease of the spine set in, and his life became one long misery. Parochial aid was refused unless they would go into the poorhouse. But the one thing Mrs. Sansius would not bring herself to endure was the separation from her son which was demanded of her as a condition of relief. For 30 hours they had been without food, when the father, maddened by the moanings of his wife and child, rushed into the street, and passing a baker's shop which appeared to be empty, stole from it a loaf of bread. The proprietor, however, saw the action from an inner room. He did not care to give the thief in charge, necessitating as it would several attendances at the police court. He took the administration of justice into his own hands, and dealt the unhappy man 2 severe blows in the face. To a healthy person, the punishment would have done comparatively little harm, but Sansius was weakened by disease and starvation, and the shock of the blows was too much for him. He fell prone on the pavement, and all attempts to restore him to consciousness proved unavailing. Then his history became public property. Scores of people remembered the pleasant-mannered, well-looking young man who had distinguished himself at college, and for whom life seemed to promise a pleasant journey. The horrible condition of his wife and child, the desperation that drove him to the one lapse from an otherwise stainless life, the frightful contrast between the hidden poverty and the gorgeous wealth of the great metropolis, became themes upon which every newspaper dilated after its own fashion. Some papers even went so far as to ask, was it a crime for a man to steal a loaf of bread to save his wife and child from starvation? In grim contrast with the terrible conclusion of his wretched career, the publicity cast upon it elicited the fact that a few weeks earlier he had inherited by the death of a distant relative an enormous fortune. All efforts to trace him through the changes of residence that increasing poverty had necessitated having proved unavailing. Now that the wretched father and husband was dead, the wife for whom the bread was stolen had become a great lady. The boy was at length to receive the aid that wealth could give him. Poor George Claude Sansius has nothing to do with our story. But his fate led to the alleviation of a great deal of misery that otherwise might have been in store for millions of human beings. Loud and clear rang out the cry. What was the use of denouncing slavery when want like this was allowed to pass unheeded by the side of superfluous wealth? The slave owner has sufficient interest in his slaves, it was alleged, as a rule, to care for their well-being. Even criminals were clothed and fed. Had not, it was asked, every human being the right to demand from a world which, through the resources of experience and science, became constantly more productive, a sufficiency of subsistence? The inquest room was crowded. The coroner and jury were strongly affected as they viewed the body laid out in a luxuriously appointed coffin. Wealth denied to the living was lavished on the dead. No longer in rags and tatters, the lifeless body seemed to revert to the past. Shrunken as was the frame, and emaciated the features, there remained evidence sufficient to show that the now inanimate form was once a fine and handsome man. The evidence was short, and the summing up of the coroner decisive. He insisted that the baker had not willfully committed wrong and should not be made responsible for the consequences that followed his rough recovery of his property. A butcher and a general provision dealer on the jury took strongly the same view. How are poor tradesmen to protect themselves? They must take the law in their own hands, they argued. Otherwise, it would be better to submit to being robbed than to waste their time in police courts. They wanted a verdict of justifiable homicide. Another juryman, a small builder, urged a verdict of misadventure. At first, he called it peradventure. But the rest of the jury felt otherwise. Some desired a verdict of manslaughter. And it was long before the compromise of death by accident was agreed to. Deep groans filled the room as the result was announced. That same night, a large crowd of men and women assembled outside the baker's shop with hostile demonstrations. The windows were destroyed, and an attempt made to break in the door. A serious riot would probably have ensued but for the arrival of a large body of police. Again, the fate of George Sonsius became the familiar topic of the press. But the impression was not an ephemeral one. The fierce spirit of discontent which for years had been smoldering burst into flames. A secret society called the Live and Let Live was formed, with ramifications throughout the world. The force of numbers, the force of brute strength, was appealed to. A bold and outspoken declaration was made that every human being had an inherent right to sufficient food and clothing and comfortable lodging. Truly, poor George Sonsius died for the good of many millions of his fellow creatures. Our history will show the point at length achieved. Shortly after poor Sonsius's death, a remarkable meeting was held in the City of London. The representatives of six of the largest financial houses throughout the globe assembled by agreement to discuss the present material condition of the world and its future prospects. There was Lord de Cardross, head of the English house of that name and chief, moreover, of the family, whose branches presided over princely houses of finance in six of the chief cities of the continent of Europe. Second only in power in Great Britain, the House of Bisdat and Company was represented by Charles James Bisdat, a man of scarcely 40, but held to be the greatest living authority on abstruse financial questions. The Dutch House of Von Surge Brothers was represented by its head, Cornelius Julius Von Surge. The greatest finance house in America, Worgen Brice and Company, appeared by its chief, Henry Tudor Worgen, and the scarcely less powerful house of Locke, Stanfield and Company of San Francisco, Melbourne, Sydney, and Wellington was represented by its chief, Alfred Demetrius. The German and African house of Werther Scribe and Company was present in the person of its head, Baron Scribe, and the French and continental houses of the de Cardross family were represented by the future head of the family, the Baroness de Cardross. The deliberations were carried out in French. Two or more of these houses had no doubt from time to time worked together in one transaction, but their uniform position was one of independence toward each other, verging more towards antagonism than to union. In fact, the junction for ordinary purposes of such vast powers of these kings of finance wielded would be fatal to liberty and freedom. A single instance will suffice to show the power referred to, which even one group of financiers could wield. 5 years previously, all Europe was in a ferment. War was expected from every quarter. It depended not on one, but on many questions. The alliances were doubtful. Nothing seemed certain but that neutrality would be impossible, and that the continent would be divided into two or more great camps. The final decision appeared to rest with Great Britain. There an ominous disposition for war was displaying itself. The inclination of the sovereign and the cabinet was supposed to be in that direction. But the family of de Cardrosses throughout Europe was for peace. The chief of the family was the head of the English house, and it was decided he should interview the Prime Minister of England and acquaint him with the views of the great financial group. His reception was not flattering, but if he felt mortified, he did not show it. He expressed himself deeply sensible of the honor done to him by him being allowed to state his opinions, and with a reverential inclination he bowed himself from the presence of the greatest statesman of his day, the Right Honorable Randolph Stanley. That afternoon it was bruited about that, in the view of coming possibilities, the Durkard Rose family had determined to realize securities all over Europe and send gold to America. The next morning a disposition to sell was reported from every direction, and 5 million sterling of gold were collected for dispatch to New York. In 24 hours there was a great panic throughout Great Britain and Europe. The Bank of England asked for permission to suspend specie payments, but could indicate no limit to which such a permission should be set. It seemed as if Europe would be drained of gold. The great rivals of the Durkard Roses looked on and either could not, or would not, interfere. A hurried cabinet meeting was convened, and as a result, a conference by telephone was arranged between the Prime Minister of Great Britain and the ministers of the great powers of Europe. Commencing by twos and threes, the conference developed into an assemblage for conversational purposes of at least 20 of the chief statesmen and diplomatists of the Old World. Rumor said that even monarchs in two or three cases were present and inspired the telephonic utterances of their ministers. How the result was arrived at was known best to those who took part in the conference, but peace and disarmament were agreed on if certain contingencies involving the exercise of vast power and the expenditure of enormous capital could be provided for. No other conclusion could be arrived at, and one way or the other, the outcome had to be settled within 24 hours. The conference had lasted from 10 o'clock to 4. At 5 o'clock, by invitation, Lord Durkard Rose waited on the Prime Minister, who received him much more cordially than before. "You have caused me," he said, "to learn a great deal during the last 48 hours. I could not presume to teach you anything. Events have spoken," was the reply. "And who controlled them, if not the houses of Durkard Rose? You do us too much honor. It is you who govern. We are of those who are governed." "The alliance between power and modesty," said the Prime Minister, with pardonable irony, "is irresistible. Tell me, my lord, is it too late for your views to prevail?" A slight, almost imperceptible start was the only movement that Durkard Rose made. The enormous self-repression he was exercising cannot be exaggerated. The future strength of the family depended on the issue. There was, however, no tremor in his voice when he answered, "If you adopt them, I do not think it is too late." "But do you realize the sacrifices in all directions that have to be made?" said the minister in faltering tones. "I think I do." "And you think to secure peace those sacrifices should be made?" "I do." "Will you tell me what those sacrifices are?" he asked. Lord Durkard Rose smiled. "You desire me," he said, "to tell you what you already know." Then he proceeded to describe to the amazed Prime Minister in brief but pregnant terms, one after the other, the conditions that had been agreed on. Once only he paused and indicated that the condition he was describing he accepted reluctantly. "I do not conceal," said the astounded Prime Minister, "my surprise at the extent of your knowledge, and clearly you approve the only compromise possible. It is needless to tell you that the acceptance of this compromise requires the use of means not at the disposal of the governments. In one word, will it suit you to supply them?" "I might," responded Lord Durkard Rose, "ask you until 2 o'clock tomorrow to give an answer. But I do not wish to add to your anxiety. If you will undertake to entirely and absolutely confine within your own breasts the knowledge of what my answer will be, I will undertake that answer at 2 o'clock tomorrow shall be yes." Silently they shook hands. Probably these two men had never before so thoroughly appreciated the strength and speciality of their several powers. The panic continued until 2 o'clock the following day, when an enormous reaction took place. The part the Durkard Rose family played in securing peace was suspected by a few only. Its full extent the Prime Minister alone knew. He it was who enjoyed the credit for saving the world from a desolating war. And now, after an interval of 5 years, the sovereigns of finance met in conclave. In obedience to the generally expressed wish, Lord Durkard Rose took the chair. "I need scarcely say," he began, "that I am deeply sensible of the compliment you pay me in asking me to preside over such a meeting. We in this room represent a living power throughout the globe, before which the reigning sovereigns of the world are comparatively helpless. But, because of our great strength, it is undesirable that we should work unitedly except for very great and humane objects. For the mere purpose of money-making, I feel assured you all agree with me in desiring no combination, no monopoly that would pit us against the rest of the world. He paused for a moment, evidently desiring to disguise the strength of the emotion with which he spoke. He resumed in slower and apparently more mastered words. I wish I could put it to you sufficiently strongly that our houses would not have considered any good that could result to them, and to you a sufficient excuse for inviting such a combination. We hold that the only cause that could justify it is the conviction that, for the good of mankind, a vast power requires to be wielded which is not to be found in the ordinary machinery of government. A murmur of applause went round the table, and Mr. Demetrius, with much feeling, said, You make me very happy by the assurance you have given. I will not conceal from you that our house anticipated this much, or it would not have been represented. We are too largely concerned with states in which free institutions are permanent not to avoid anything which might savor of a disposition to combine financial forces for the benefit of financial houses. Lord de Cardross then proceeded to explain that his family, in serious and prolonged conclave, could come to no other conclusion than that certain influences were at work which would cause a great suffering to mankind, and sap and destroy the best institutions which civilization and science had combined to create. The time had come to answer the question, should human knowledge, human wants, and human skill continue to advance to an extent to which no limit could be put? Or should the survival of the fittest and strongest be fought out in a period of anarchy? It amounts, he said in a tone of profound conviction, to this, the ills under which the masses suffer accumulate. There is no use in comparing what they have today with what they had 50 years ago. A person who grows from infancy to manhood in a prison may feel contented until he knows what the liberty is that others enjoy. The born blind are happier than those who become blind by accident. To our masses, the knowledge of liberty is open, and they feel they are needlessly deprived of it. Wider and wider to their increasing knowledge opens out the horizon of possible delights. More and more do they feel that they are deprived of what of right belongs to them. He paused, as if inviting some remarks from his hearers. Mr. Bizdat, who spoke in an interrogative rather than an affirmative tone, took up the thread. I am right, I think, in concluding that your remarks do not point against or in favor of any school of politics or doctrines of party? You direct our notice to causes below the surface to which the government of the day, I had almost said the hour, do not penetrate. Causes which you believe, if left to unchecked operation, will undermine the whole social fabric? It is so, emphatically replied Lord de Cardross. The evils are not only apparent, but equally apparent is it that no remedy is being applied, and that we are riding headlong to anarchy. Again he paused, and Mr. Rorgan took up the discussion. If we, he said, the princes of finance, do not find a remedy, how long will the enlarged intelligence of the people submit to conditions which are at war with the theory of equality and liberty of mankind? Yes, said the Baroness de Cardross, speaking for the first time. It is clear there is a limit to the inequality of fortune to which men and women will submit. Equality of possessions there cannot be, but, if I may indulge in metaphor, we cannot expect that the bulk of humankind will be content with being entirely shut out from the sunlight of existence. The gentleman present bowed low in approval, and Mr. Demetrius said, The simile of the Baroness is singularly appropriate. There are myriads of human beings to whom the sunshine of life is denied. A too universal evil invites resistance by means which in lesser cases might be scouted. In short, if the remedy is left to anarchy, anarchy there will be. Even in our young lands the shadow of the coming evil is beginning to show itself. Indeed, he added with an air of musing abstraction, it is not unfair to deduce from what has been said that, even if the evils are less in the new lands of the West and the South, superior general intelligence may more than proportionally increase the wants of the multitude, and the sense of wrong under which they labor. The conference extended over 3 days. Everyone agreed that interference with the ordinary conditions of finance was inexpedient except in extreme cases. But they were unanimous in thinking that an extreme case had to be dealt with. They finally decided by the use of an extended paper currency, with its necessary guarantees, to increase the circulating medium and to raise the prices of both products and labor. Some other decisions were adopted, having a special reference to the employment of labor and insurance against want in cases of disablement through illness, accident, or old age. So ended the most remarkable conference of any age or time. This episode of Reading Kiwi has been brought to you by Claire Lacey.